Dallas, Texas, deep in the heart of Bush Country. You're listening to RadioLeft.com.
Where investigative bloggers meet the media. It's Blog Call on RadioLeft.com. This is Jeff Staples in the Radio Left studios, and it's Tuesday, so it's Blog Call. This is, I think, Bob Furtick from Democrats.com, what, our sixth blog call now?
This is number six.
Yeah, this is really great. We're going to be talking today about the bankruptcy bill. And we have a guest who's going to tell us all about what the problems with it are and why it is that we need to get the Democrats to oppose it. So go ahead, Bob, and introduce our guest.
Yes, our guest today is David Swanson of DebtSlavery.org, who's been exposing the credit card industry's corrupt campaign to push its terrible bankruptcy bill through the House of Representatives this week, as well as the campaign by bloggers and activists to stop it. David, why don't you start?
Sure. I want to preface this by saying that I'm not a lawyer, not a banker, not an expert on bankruptcy. I did work for a number of years for a community organization called Acorn that lobbied against this bill, which the credit card industry has been pushing for several years. I worked for Labor, which has opposed this bill, and for the past week and a half, I've worked for DebtSlavery.org, which was started by Democrats.com in order to fight this bill in the House. And I serve on the board of Progressive Democrats of America, which is organizing rallies tomorrow against this bill. I did write an article examining the bill, and the bill, by the way, is Senate Bill 256, S-256. The House is voting on the same bill from the Senate in order to do it more quickly. And that article can be found at blackcommentator.com. But that was written before DebtSlavery.org had pulled together a huge coalition and started making a lot of noise, so there is more to tell now. In terms of funding, you know, there has been some reporting in the media, in the New York Times, over $40 million from various credit card and auto loan companies since 1989 in campaign funding to Congress members alone on this bill. And it's pretty clear that credit card companies are not the whole story. There are the auto loan companies that stand to gain significantly from this bill. The Chamber of Commerce has been lobbying for this bill. Any corporation that fears it might someday end up in bankruptcy is going to be for this bill because it's very friendly to corporations and very hard on individuals and families. What's interesting to me about this bill is that I don't see any redeeming features. You know, in most bills there are elements that are good for some people, not just for corporate profits, and usually a case can be made, even if it's not entirely persuasive, that it's a good bill. And so lobbying Congress members is difficult. On this one, it ought to be much easier than it is because this is one of the worst bills that I've seen. And if you look around the internet, the left, center, and right wing bloggers are against it. If you look at the political publications, magazines, you have magazines like the New Republic against it because it makes the moderate Democrats look as bad as the left Democrats say they are, and so forth. There's widespread agreement on some of the problems in this bill. So let's just look quickly at a few of them. There are two points of view really out there in the media on this. One is that that there's extreme fraud, that people are going bankrupt in order to get out of paying back what they've borrowed. That everybody is scamming the system, and we need to crack down on them. The other claim is that most people go bankrupt as an absolute last resort. Many of them have gone without food and utilities, and and medical expenses and prescriptions. Over half of families who go bankrupt are do so because of medical expenses and so forth. And if you look at the evidence that I've been able to find, you know, the most extreme claim for fraud that I've been seeing is for 10%. You know, usually the argument is made that bankruptcies are up, and then you just sort of flow into the need to crack down on fraud without actually presenting any evidence that bankruptcies are up because of fraud. And when you get specific claims, the most extreme that I've seen is for 10%. But then apparently there are no FBI or IRS records to back that up whatsoever. And the American Bankruptcy Institute claims that at most 3% of filers get out of paying any debts that that they actually could have paid. But, you know, the more interesting, broader picture on this, I think, is that if you assume it's 10%, or if you even double it and say it's 20%, you know, who writes the bill that affects an entire system shaped around 20% of the cases? And why don't we question that? You know, you also have, in looking at that, to set aside the glaring fact that the most blatant scams, the most blatant abusers of the current system have explicit loopholes in the law that are left in by this bill. That includes loopholes for millionaires and for corporations. So you have what are called asset protection trusts, which allow those who can afford the high legal expenses to do it to stash away unlimited amounts of wealth and keep it out of the bankruptcy proceedings. You have unlimited homestead exemptions, and the drafters of this bill are aware of that because they've required that you you have purchased the home 3 1/3 years prior to filing bankruptcy. But if as long as you've done that, the home can be worth untold millions, and you can keep it. We have cross-country judge shopping. You know, you can shop from state to state. If you're Enron, you don't need to deal with angry people in Houston. You can go to New York and find a friendlier judge, and that's left in there. You know, what was just taken away from people who want to file class action suits is left in there for corporations. You know, and some of this is argued for on a basis of states' rights. We can't force states to allow elderly couples to keep their homes or to set limits on these loopholes. It's states' rights. You know, the same thing that in the coming weeks we will hear reversed when the Republicans in Congress try to take away all state and local laws on predatory lending with a bill from Bob May of Ohio. But you know, setting aside all of those big scale scams that are left in, you have a bill that's written to address 3% of the cases. The evidence from the other side is far more substantive. You know, there have been studies done and presented in the Senate and House Judiciary Committee hearings. An extensive study done by five academics, led most publicly by a professor from Harvard, which found that about 50% of families who are forced to file for bankruptcy do so as a result of medical expenses, and about 3/4 of those had health insurance. So it's not just people who didn't have health insurance. You know, about another 40%, according to various studies, suffered a death in the family of a breadwinner, or lost a job, or got a divorce, or some combination of all of these factors. And almost everyone, it looks like, files for bankruptcy as a last resort, which is what you would expect of something that's an incredible hassle that leaves you with terrible credit on your record for the next decade, that in some cases makes it hard to get a job. This is not something people are eager to dive into. You have 61% of those who have gone, who filed for bankruptcy, have gone without medical care because they couldn't afford it but needed it. 50% have failed to get prescriptions filled. 1/3 have had their utilities shut off. 21% have gone without food, 7% have moved their elderly parents to cheaper care facilities. You can go to debtslavery.org and click on links and find links to various studies on these issues. So then looking at what the bill does, there are a couple things to look at quickly. One is what it does and one is what it doesn't do in light of several dozen amendments proposed and rejected. And what it does do, you know, is the thing that's been promoted most heavily is the creation of a means test, which is a little misleading in that my understanding is there currently is a means test. It's just performed by a judge, and a judge who's able to look at all the facts and the specific details and actual income and expenses. Under the new means test, that won't happen. A judge will not only be unable to distinguish between a case of someone whose child has diabetes and someone who's gone on a crazy shopping spree, but will also be unable to look at actual expenses. You will be required to use standard government figures. So it doesn't matter, you know, if your rent is actually 50% or 100% more than what the government says your rent should be. That's what will be figured in the calculation. And it doesn't matter if you just lost your job or your income has dropped. Your income will be calculated based on the previous 6 months. So the means test is something that's not going to target 3% of people with something stricter to make them shape up. It's something that's going to lay a burden on the majority of people in a really unfair and unproductive way. And so you're going to also have with this, and this applies to those below median income who are not subjected to the means test, you're going to have huge additional legal costs and expenses and paperwork, and you're going to be required to purchase loan counseling, even if there isn't any within an hour's or 2 hours or 3 hours drive of you. You're going to have to find it, pay for it, get to it, and even if the company is a bunch of predators looking for further ways to rip you off, you're going to need to pay them to give you counseling. The general result is that a lot of people are not going to be able to file under Chapter 7 bankruptcy, which lets you make a new and difficult start of things. You're going to have to file under Chapter 13, get on a plan, a long-term plan to make payments, and in many cases they will be payments you cannot afford to make and it will fall apart. And more people will lose their homes. Some people will lose some of the money coming to them in child support will be delayed and will go first to creditors. But, you know, it's a very complicated bill. There are aspects of it I don't claim to fathom. But if you look at the amendments that have been rejected, it becomes clear that this is a bill that the Republicans in Congress, in the Senate and in the House Judiciary, did not want any sort of humane elements in. So amendments that were rejected in the Senate include closing off the trust loopholes for millionaires, limiting the homestead exemption, creating a minimum homestead exemption so that an elderly couple can possibly keep their modest house, protecting employees and retirees from corporate practices that take away their earnings and their retirement savings when the business files for bankruptcy, discouraging predatory lending practices, exempting debtors from means testing if their problem was the result of identity theft, which is often itself the result of negligence by the same companies that are the creditors here, limiting the amount of interest to 30% on payments under bankruptcy. 30% is hardly low interest. Preserving protections for individuals under economic distress as caregivers to ill or disabled family members, on and on, endless amendments that were rejected. If you're if your debt was caused by serious medical problems, you should be exempt from means testing. That was rejected. Protection for medical debt homeowners, rejected. Enhanced disclosure to make clear to individuals under bankruptcy what they're paying to who, how much, when, and where, rejected. Protection, and this is a real, this is what really gets a lot of people. Protection for service members and veterans from means testing in bankruptcy, rejected. Protection of service members from outrageous, usurious interest rates, rejected. Allowing service members to exempt property based on the law of the state where they lived prior to service, rejected. So this is a bill, and I could read through a similar list and a longer one from both houses of Congress, you know, looking at the amendments that have been rejected in the House Judiciary Committee. It's phenomenal. The House Judiciary Committee has passed this bill, as the full Senate has, and we expect the House Rules Committee to put the bill out possibly later today to the full House with a closed rule, meaning no amendments. So the full House will be looking at the exact bill that has been passed by the full Senate, and if the House passes it, it will go straight to the White House. A couple other things to note. One, in the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator John Cornyn, who's made the news today for some interesting comments related to violence against judges, expressed his strong support for the bankruptcy bill, but he introduced a separate bill that would prevent corporations filing for bankruptcy from shopping around from state to state for a friendly judge. He did not introduce that as an amendment, and so he did not have to vote against it, but I'm not clear that he wouldn't have. He does not have a single co-sponsor on the bill, and it doesn't seem to be going anywhere. So there's been a lot of mixed messages from Republicans and Democrats alike on this. There were 18 Democratic senators and one independent who voted for the bill, some of whom had spoken out against it. There was one who voted for cloture on the bill and then voted against it. There was one Democrat who chose not to vote at all. What we're seeing now is sort of a conclusion among those in the know and the mainstream media that the Senate was where defeat was possible, and it's a done deal now. And we're seeing, on the other hand, all across the internet and among grassroots groups and activist groups and labor and all sorts of organizations that whose members have been enraged by seeing this go through the Senate, particularly with so much Democratic support, we're seeing a movement to make a lot of noise about this and try to stop it in the House and to make sure that every Congress member understands that people will remember this next year. And so DebtSlavery.org has pulled together a coalition that includes Progressive Democrats of America, the AFL-CIO, People's Email Network, the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, Democracy Week, Public Citizen, Center for American Progress, Billionaires for Bush, et cetera, et cetera. And that the list is on the website, debtslavery.org. And so all of these organizations have been reaching out to their members, asking them to send in emails and make phone calls. I know that we have well over 10,000 emails sent in from Democrats.com and People's Email Network alone. Similar number perhaps from Progressive Democrats of America, certainly thousands, and The Nation magazine sent out an email last night. We expect probably 100,000 emails today and tomorrow, and we're encouraging everyone to make phone calls into Congress. On the Democrats.com website, as soon as you send an email, you get the phone number of your Congress member. In addition, we're planning rallies in various cities tomorrow, and we're working with Democratic Congress members who want to oppose this to try to energize those in the House who want to take a stand. that's sort of a brief summary of where we're coming from.
Well, David Swanson, having heard the description of this bill and what's going on with it, I suppose that means that the banking industry is and the credit card industry are in desperate straits, and they're just losing money hand over fist, and if they don't have the bankruptcy laws tightened up, they're going to go out of business, huh?
The credit card industry made a mere $30 billion last year, which was only the record in the past 15 years, and they seem to make more each year than the last.
So you mean they're having record profits rather than being in dire straits?
Not only are they having record profits, but they're deceiving their customers because their rates are not based on the questions that are addressed in this bill, and they are not making any sort of commitment. They're just hinting and claiming that rates will go down if this bill cracks down on lawbreakers. You know, the problem is that credit cards charge different rates to different people. If you have good credit, they'll charge you 9%. If you have awful credit, they'll charge you 30%. And the reason they charge the 30% is to cover themselves for the risk that you might not pay them back. Well, now here they come to the government saying, if it should ever happen that anybody can't pay us back, we want you to cover it. We want you to bail us out. Well, if they're going to do that, then they need to go back to everybody that they didn't charge 9% and give them back the difference that they paid in extra interest. You know, these folks...
Well, wait a minute. Are you saying that there is a taxpayer-funded slush fund out of which bad debts will be repaid to the government, to these companies? That's not what you're saying, is it?
No. I'm saying that in those cases where someone is unable to pay all of their debt, when they've been hit with a medical disaster or a combination of other disasters, that what's going to happen now is that instead of being able to cancel a portion of their debt and make a new start, in which case the credit card company ought to survive well on the basis of the high interest rates it's charging, instead of that, the government is going to say to people, look, we're going to have to take your house. We're going to have to take your car. We're going to have to delay some of those child support payments you were expecting. We're not going to help you out just because your brother or your daughter is on life support. What we're going to do is put you on a long-term plan of making all your payments to the credit card company, and we're going to put that ahead of everything. And the credit card company is going to get their money sooner or later. And if this results in a form of debt slavery for you, and you can never get out of it, and you can never recover in advance, and you know, if you're a small business entrepreneur that we love to praise and use in our commercials, and you've taken a risk but lost, you know, sorry, game's up. You don't get another try. And so it's a question of a very, very profitable industry demanding more, and a crisis being manufactured, as with Social Security, to demand it.
Okay, let's open up the floor to questions. Anybody want to step forward? Just press 6 to unmute yourself.
Hi, this is Chris Herman from Newtowns. I'm wondering if you know, is there interest on those long-term payments under the new plan?
Well, that's certainly my understanding. In fact, there was an amendment, I think I mentioned, to limit interest to 30%, which was voted down. So there's not only interest, but there's high interest. And, you know, there are not just high interest rates even before getting into bankruptcy, but there are penalties, and there are people who have paid back more than they borrowed and more than what the interest should have been through all of the penalties, and are trapped. You know, we have cases of what's called negative amortization, where you're making all your payments, but what you owe is increasing. And you know, this is a form of what looks like permanent debt slavery.
That 30% number that referred to the interest cap proposed for late payments,
it was a cap on payments under for someone under bankruptcy. This was an amendment in the Senate. I don't have it in front of me, but it's you can find it on our website.
Okay, on the bankruptcy portion. So it did not limit the initial interest rate on your card.
Oh, absolutely not. That can be well. I mean, it didn't limit anything because it was voted down. But it would not have limited initial interest rates on your card, which can be well over that. You know, and Congressman Bernie Sanders of Vermont has just introduced a bill that would limit those rates. I think I've got the details here somewhere, but this is a separate bill called the Loan Shark Prevention Act, introduced by Congressman Sanders, that would ban credit card companies from the sort of bait and switch where they start out with a real low rate and then triple it, and it would limit interest rates to 8% above whatever the IRS is charging tax deadbeats. So that currently would be 14%. So by some miracle, were Congressman Sanders' bill to pass, that would limit rates to you know, to something closer to the standard of usury that the Bible advocates.
Can you talk a little bit about the debt, the predatory lending bill that's also you mentioned earlier, Bob Ney?
Sure. There, you know, predatory lending in the form of high-cost mortgage lending is a problem that has caused many neighborhoods to have a lot of boarded-up homes. You know, people build up equity in a house, and then a mortgage lender, a refinance lender, comes along and says, wouldn't you like to have some cash? You can see you're in trouble. You need some home improvements. You need to pay some medical bills. You've got the money waiting in your house. We'll just take it out for you. And the list of tricks and abuses and deceptions could go on for hours. You know, the people's taxes and fees are left out, and they get hit with a bill at the end of the year. People are charged outrageous rates that increase. People are charged for extra products and fees that are built in with the interest on them. People are loaned more money than the house is worth, so no good lender will bail them out, etc. And so neighborhood groups, including the community group Acorn that I used to work for, have lobbied for bills at the city and state level, and rather hopelessly at the federal level as well, to crack down on some of these abusive practices. And as often happens with these grassroots movements, a lot of city bills have been passed, and then some of them have been overturned by state bills, preempting any local laws. And then a number of good state bills have been passed as well. And the lending industry has really stopped fighting at the local level and has restricted itself to efforts to preempt local laws at the state level. But what they really want, and what they've been introducing for a few years now and dreaming of, is Representative Bob Ney's bill. This is Mr. Freedom Fries, Bob Ney from Ohio. His chief funding comes from the lending industry. His bill would tear up all local and state laws and say that only the federal government can make laws restricting high-cost lending. And, you know, the bill has some Orwellian title, like the Responsibility Lending Act or something, but its primary function is to eliminate all of the local and state laws that local and state legislatures have spent years crafting and perfecting, and which have an incredible record of not drying up good loans, but blocking the bad loans. So the longer it takes them to get this bill through Congress, the more evidence will keep piling up that their argument is bogus, that that restricting bad lending will dry up good lending. It just it hasn't happened.
Okay. Other questions?
Here in Texas, David Swanson, this is Jeff Staples with Radio Left. They have actually passed a law now which allows condominium associations to foreclose on their homeowners for past due association dues. I have a neighbor who was behind her. She got separated from her husband. Her husband left. She had been the primary wage earner, but he left her with $2,500 or so in back condominium association dues. So the condominium, she tried to work out something with the condominium association. They refused to work out a payment schedule and said they foreclosed upon her. So she had to spend $2,500 in order to pay an attorney, filing fees and so on, in order to stop the foreclosure. Because when the condominium association decided they were going to foreclose, it went up from $2,500 to over $4,000 to include penalties and attorney's fees to do the foreclosure, which she didn't have. So now, for a $2,500 bill, which could have been paid back to the condominium association over a period of a year, she has incurred over $5,000 in expenses. And the condominium association will get their money over a five-year period through a court-ordered payment plan. So it doesn't even help the condominium association that foreclosed on her.
Right. I guess it helps lawyers if it helps anyone. But the way that the Republican Congress members in particular think, who promote things like this bankruptcy bill, is that, well, it's fair to everyone. Everyone has the ability to go out and hire a high-priced lawyer if they choose to, just like everyone has the right to sleep under a bridge if they feel like it. And the reason that the Asset Protection Trust is referred to as a loophole for millionaires is that only millionaires can afford the legal expense of creating it. And the reason that the legal requirements and the paperwork are such a heavy burden on low-income families that will file for bankruptcy under this new law if it passes, is exactly the sort of scenario that you just described. The legal expenses become the major cost and problem rather than what was there to begin with. And I've read some arguments that there will be many lawyers who first of all, because they will be liable for any false information under filing for their clients under bankruptcy under this new law, will either charge much higher prices or will refuse to do it, because they'll have to investigate their clients and make sure of everything, and so the costs are going to be extreme and. On top of this insanity of having to, find a predatory loan counseling company or organization and in a rural area possibly have to travel for hours to get to it and pay for it, it's just not helpful. And there are many lawyers and judges who have come out strongly against this bill. I mean, this is not the creation of lawyers looking for work. This is a creation of credit card companies and auto companies and other corporations looking to squeeze the last drop out of people.
I will tell you, David Swanson, that I've talked with an attorney, a local bankruptcy attorney, about this bill, and what she tells me is that she is at the moment doing land office business in bankruptcies, and this is in addition to the fact that that a huge number of people are declaring bankruptcies. 50% of them are due to catastrophic medical expenses and so on. But what's happening is people who would ordinarily attempt to work it out without going through a bankruptcy, but are afraid they may not be able to achieve working it out, are declaring bankruptcy now so that if this new law takes effect, they will be protected, because if they couldn't work it out and they did have to declare bankruptcy, they would be ineligible, or the terms would be so much worse that it's better to do the bankruptcy instead of trying to work yourself out of it first.
Yeah, all right. Let's take a moment to let others ask questions. All right, well, I just want to pass along thanks to the magic of the Internet. I just got an announcement from Capitol Hill that the bill that we're talking about has been taken off the House calendar for this week. So folks who are trying to organize opposition to this have an additional week to convey their messages to Congress. I know Democrats.com, we've been able to get over 10,000 emails and calls into Congress. So, David, how do you think that affects the battle to come?
It's terrific. I know we had heard rumors of this earlier today, but I still don't know the reason or the motivation behind it. I'm interested to look into it, as I'm sure you are, but I think that it helps us tremendously, because we've built this incredible coalition in 5 or 6 days, and we've begun organizing events and rallies and campaigns to pressure Congress members, and we were feeling pretty pressed for time. We now have something up and running that can grow further and be put into action over the next week or so, and I think it gives us a fighting chance.
And David Swanson, that's debtslavery.org, right?
Correct, yes.
Yeah, and just to remind our listeners, there's another point that needs to be made, and that is that it is unconstitutional to send someone to debtor's prison for their debts. So what is being done here is, this is in essence of exactly what you called it, David, and that is debt slavery. Because what will happen is, if you won't go to debtor's prison, but you won't be able to relieve yourself of these debts, so you will literally be living hand to mouth for the rest of your life while you're paying most of your income to pay back for past catastrophic medical expenses, or for that matter, even as George Bush has said, when I was young and irresponsible, that is young and irresponsible behavior by people who aren't multimillionaires to have their daddies bail them out.
That's right. It's not debtor's prison. It's a feudal system. It's sharecropping. It's putting someone in the control indefinitely of a creditor, and it's taking away your ability to build income and wealth for your family and for your children, and directing your energies to the profits of these poor, suffering credit card companies.
Well, in fact, it's a very simple case, David Swanson, and that is, anyone that has these problems just simply didn't plan very well, because if they had planned properly, they would have arranged to have been born into a wealthy family.
Right. I think that's what's expected of us, and this is part of a trend we're seeing that's moving ever more swiftly toward a more strongly divided country. One of the endless amendments was something to do with setting the college loan expenses outside of what you lose under bankruptcy. It's hard enough already for low and moderate income families to send someone to college and let provide some possibility that the children of Walmart workers are not Walmart workers, but this eats away at that, and this divides us further into those who live like and hang out with multimillionaire senators and those who can't dream of that.
And of course, one of the big problems here is that the wealth, the divide between the rich and the poor, after the Great Depression, it started declining, so that there was less of a gap between rich and poor. And then at the point of the election of Ronald Reagan, that gap started widening again. So then when Bill Clinton came into office, it continued to widen, but the rate at which it was widening dropped dramatically because people on the bottom were actually pulling themselves up due to better employment and things of that nature. And now the gap between the rich and the poor is widening at the fastest rate ever in the history of our country. And that's apparently not good enough for these people. We're creating more billionaires and more bankruptcies at the moment than in any other time in our country.
We are, and more discontent with the system as well. I mean, I haven't seen a single poll done by the media on the bankruptcy bill. Maybe now we'll have some time, and we can encourage some of the polling and organizations to do so. But I can't imagine that that most Americans are eager to see this legislation put through. Not based on what we're seeing and hearing on the internet and from our allied organizations. But you're right. This is part of a trend, and we have. So many real crises in this country. We have virtual erosion of the right to organize a union. We have the crumbling of the employer pension system. We have a war to which and a military to which all of our resources are being directed. And we're spending our time manufacturing crises. We're spending our time pretending that there's this vast scamming of the bankruptcy system or the Social Security system is in trouble, and we're directing our political energies to holding off those matters. Well, you know what lies beneath, you know, the loss of jobs, the erosion of income, and above all else, the lack of a decent health care system along the lines that most wealthy countries have. Gets shoved to the side. And so, you know, if these companies like General Motors wanted to do something to prevent this incredible increase in bankruptcy filings, they should do what their Canadian branch advocates, and that is push for single payer health care. There's your single biggest contributor to the rise in bankruptcy filing.
And by the way, David Swanson, if I may jump in at this point, I want to give you a couple of statistics. The United States spends $5,600 per year for every man, woman, and child in the United States for health care. That includes the 50 million who are uninsured and the 100 million who are underinsured. It's every single person in the country. All right, now, Canada spends $2,600 per capita for a universal single-payer health system. Our taxes already pay 49% of the total health care bill. That means that it's a blatant lie when you hear a politician say we can't afford a universal single-payer health care system because we're already paying more in taxes than would be required to implement one. And then the rest of that money is all being skimmed off in profits by people like HMOs, health maintenance organizations, for-profit hospitals. For example, the for-profit hospitals in Texas that got George Bush to sign a law which said they can cut off the life support for your family member over the objections of the family members if they can't pay. To keep the life support on.
Right. The hypocrisy just explodes around here these days, and And it's clear that this, you know, this bankruptcy bill would take away the possibility of getting out of debt for families exactly like Terry Schiavo's. And the concern is just sort of buried beneath the hypocritical rhetoric. But
and by the way, if the tort reform legislation that George Bush and Tom DeLay advocate, and for that matter Jeb Bush in Florida, had been implemented, Terry Schiavo's husband, Michael Schiavo, never would have been able to sue for malpractice, and Terry Schiavo would have died long ago because there wouldn't have been any money to keep her alive.
Yeah, it gets worse and worse the further you dig. But on single-payer health care, the case doesn't really need to be made. The majority of Americans, according to the media's polls, are for it. Which is remarkable because the media is so set against it. But what's disturbing is that most of the people who are for it think they're in a small minority. You know, we have majorities in this country who don't know we're majorities. And so increasingly we understand that we're wasting all of this money, as you said, on profits for the HMOs, but also on their expenses and their lobbying and their advertising and their bureaucracy, which is so much greater than the bureaucracy of Medicare. And yet we think we're nutty left wingers because that's what we're told all the time, and somehow we have to become aware of our strength and impose our demands on our government. The news that Bob just conveyed gives me a lot of hope that we can do that with the bankruptcy bill, that we can make every member of Congress understand that we're going to remember this for a year, whichever way they vote.
Well, in fact, let me bring Bob Furtick from Democrats.com back in for just a moment and ask you this question, Bob. Did you happen to notice from the report that you saw the reason for taking it off the calendar and delaying it? Did it have something to do with the pressure from the public, or was it that they thought they couldn't pass it unless they got it off the floor and pressurized more people, or what was the rationale?
No, I think this was just totally related to the desire of many members of Congress to go to Italy for the Pope's funeral. It's totally coincidental, but it obviously, offers an opportunity. One observation I would make is that there's been zero coverage of this bill anywhere. It's certainly not on TV. None of the talk shows, none of the cable networks have covered this in any way. And obviously, the Republican leadership has decided that the easiest way to pass this bill is if nobody knows that it's coming through. So folks who are trying to spread the word are up against the media blackout, which is one of the strategies the Republicans use. They control what's on television for the most part, and if they don't want something on it, they just keep it away. So, there's an opportunity here, but with this media blackout, it's very hard, in my opinion, to get people mobilized. A lot of the inside players in Washington made the calculation after it passed through the Senate, where the Democrats at least can wage a filibuster. There's no equal opportunity in the House. It's a straight up or down vote, so it's harder to fight it in the House. But people were not really aware. I mean, this bill has come forward 8 years in a row, and through one parliamentary maneuver or another, Democrats have managed to kill it. But they didn't have that capability in the Senate this year, so it really is just a House vote away, and getting that word across to people is seems to be the biggest challenge.
Well, I am going to defend. First of all, I'm going to tell you that Radio Left has actually been reporting on this for several weeks, probably a month, and also I am going to defend one newscaster, and that's Lou Dobbs on CNN. He has been reporting it and has been talking about the very negative consequences. He is their business reporter, their business reporter that has an evening business/news show in the evenings.
Well, if Lou Dobbs would give a tenth of the coverage to this effort as he's given to the vigilantes on the Arizona border, the Minutemen, who've been getting, you know, 20-minute, 30-minute segments on his show.
Yeah, but nevertheless, though, you have to admit that of all of all the reporters that I see on any kind of network news program, he exposes and talks about more of this stuff and outsourcing and things of that nature than anybody else. That doesn't mean he's perfect. It just means that he's doing a better job than people who are doing an abysmal job.
Well, I think that's right, but I think it's expecting way too little. I don't think he comes close to what Radio Left does or what a number of the smaller radio shows and publications and websites do. And I think the Tom Hartman show has been great on this on the radio. Tomorrow morning I'm going to be on the Liz Brown show in St. Louis and on Pacifica Radio nationally, both of which are all over this. There are media outlets that are into this, but in terms of the so-called mainstream media, it's been very, very limited. Not as bad as some issues, but very, very limited. And the better stuff has been on the opinion page, not on the front page or even on the front of the business page.
So
and there's been a lot on conservative talk shows and stuff, right? It has, yeah. And with some debate, not all in favor. And there have been debates on CNN and MSNBC. You know, short little soundbite debates between two academics, one for each side. But it all quieted down after the Senate vote, and that's when grassroots interest started to build up. And so we're looking for the media interest to follow suit, and we have had the problem that the Pope has passed away, and that Terry Schiavo has passed away, and that Michael Jackson is still weird, and so forth. But you know, at some point, an issue that affects this many people, this severely, I mean, of adults in this country, 1 out of 100, you know, file for bankruptcy every year. And if you're a child, you know, your chance of being in a family that files for bankruptcy is twice that high. So this is not affecting a tiny little group of the underclass, so-called. This is an issue that affects millions and millions of people. And at some point, the media is going to have to follow suit, whether they believe there's a real fight in the House or not. Well, that's the problem, is the media doesn't have to cater and pay attention to the interests of its readers and its audience. That's what we've, you know, that's why we've all been forced to become bloggers, because they don't cover some, you know, these stories that we consider important. And I hope, you know, that this blog call today has helped raise a little bit the profile of this issue and, hopefully, you know, get the word out that people do care about this, that activists are working on this, that bloggers are paying attention to this. And so let me thank you, David, for participating in this blog call, and thank you to our audience for coming, and thank you to Jeff Staples for helping host this and for recording this, and thank you to Ben Birch of WhiteRoseSociety.org for streaming this and archiving this. And we'll see everybody next week for the next blog call.
Yeah, and this is Jeff Staples in the Radio Left studios. We're going to end the program now. Don't forget that you can hear Blog Call on Radio Left on Tuesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And this program, if you're listening to it on Radio Left, is probably at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Tuesday. So bye for now.
We are the antidote to right-wing radio, RadioLeft.com.
This is Jeff Staples in the Radio Left studios. You've been listening to Blog Call on RadioLeft.com. On RadioLeft.com.